Lewis versus Odie Washington.
May it please the court, Jim Madigan as amicus. Your Honors, the issue in this case is whether Section 1997 of the Prison Litigation Reform Act provides an exhaustion of remedies defense for prison officials who have admittedly failed to respond to various formal grievances, failed to make a yes or no decision to various requests for information, failed to make a decision on requests for a polygraph examination, and also given conflicting information to an inmate as to how he might request those pieces of information. Now, before entering the procedural saga that is this case, three principles of law seem worthy of note. First, the conclusion is inescapable that Section 1997 is subject to an equitable estoppel defense. Perez explicitly anticipated it, and the Supreme Court's decision in Zipes militates in favor of it, as does a comparison to the habeas corpus exhaustion of remedies provision, in which Congress explicitly said that equitable estoppel would only be possible where the government affirmatively expressed its intent to waive reliance on an exhaustion defense. Secondly, the substantial compliance standard is really just the mirror image of that equitable estoppel principle if it is limited to those situations in which it is not that the prisoner gave up on the remedial process, but the failure of prison officials to respond is what led to delays and procedural defaults. And so we're not really asking for any new or novel standard to be applied, but simply noting that that standard is applicable where it is the prison officials, not the inmates' conduct, that has led to the procedural default.
Is it your view that, well, even if we should find equitable estoppel, is it your view that Lewis can prevail because the prison officials' actions amount to affirmative misconduct?
That is correct. As the Ninth Circuit has already noted, a pattern of misconduct in the form of non-responsiveness, that non-responsiveness is in fact affirmative misconduct when done repeatedly. Now, it is not some act versus omission distinction, as the briefs have sort of gone back and forth on, that really shows the affirmative misconduct.
But did the prison officials here make any promises to Lewis that he could have reasonably interpreted as an assurance that he didn't have to appeal his staff conduct grievance within the required 30 days?
It's not the promise that they made. What it is his reliance upon the Illinois regulations that state that, first, he assumed that his grievances would be acted upon.
But the time for appeal was clearly marked on the grievance form and, you know, made no exception for any other pending grievances. What is it that you think the prison officials did that would have affirmatively misguided Lewis into thinking that his other grievances and his other requests would alter the time for appeal?
Well, the decision on the staff conduct grievance was premised on only two things: the inability to substantiate that Carlos was responsible and an investigation report. Peter Lewis made multiple requests for that investigation report that were never responded to. And so what he would have to do is appeal without knowing the basis upon which the decision was made at the prison level. In other words, he could appeal within 30 days, but he would have nothing to say. Secondly, by not making a decision within the prescribed time periods for the Carlos grievance, that meant that these prison officials were still considering whether Carlos would or would not be subject to disciplinary action. That meant the entire factual premise of the staff conduct grievance, namely the question whether or not Carlos was responsible, was still being decided by the prison officials. And I would point to the Illinois regulations, which state that if a prison inmate believes that the problem has not been resolved, not the formal grievance, but his complaints and problems have not been resolved, it is at that point that the prisoner has 30 days to appeal. But in this case, Peter Lewis filed two grievances, one against prison officials, one against inmate Carlos. The only reason the prison officials' grievance was not granted was, in effect, they had not yet substantiated Mr. Carlos's culpability for the attack. But by leaving that issue open and continuing to mull over it, as presumably they did since that grievance has never been formally acted upon, Peter Lewis, in fact, waited to find out what the decision would be. But more importantly, he also made multiple requests to them to make them understand that the investigation report, the polygraph request, as well as a disposition on inmate Carlos, were all the things he needed to know. Because why would he appeal if, in fact, the prison officials were still deciding to act upon his grievances?
Do you think we should remand the claim to the district court to determine whether Lewis exhausted his administrative remedies?
Well, I do believe that would be the case, since there was no evidentiary hearing held on whether Lewis exhausted. Rather, the court had a merit review hearing to find out if the claim was frivolous, apparently did not find it frivolous at the outset, and instead dismissed the case, gave Lewis an opportunity to explain himself. Once Lewis explained himself with a submission to the court, the district court filed some sort of ambiguous minute order, which required this court to have the parties file briefs whether or not there was a final judgment in that case, because it was unclear what the district court has decided. So it's never clear that the district court has made a decision, except for its reference when it took up the question of whether this was a frivolous appeal. The district court intimated that Perez does in fact militate against this claim because he did not pursue his remedies up through the appellate chain. And that this court's recent decision in Pozo would also intimate that. The problem is neither Perez nor Pozo took up the question of whether an inmate's procedural default, which is caused while awaiting prison officials' responses, is therefore barred by the administrative exhaustion provision. Neither of those cases had an allegation of prison officials completely and repeatedly ignoring the prisoner. But one thing that I think is crucial that the district court absolutely never considered is the fact that this complaint was not just a failure to protect claim. In fact, that's not even what the complaint centers on. The complaint instead states that the prison officials conspired together to shield the institution and themselves from legal ramifications by attempting to smother efforts by plaintiff to bring charges against Carlos and by preventing him from effectively grieving the deliberate indifference of defendant's lieutenant.
Well, we know that's wrong because he filed two grievances, right?
Well, he filed two grievances, and my point is that this complaint centers not on those officers not protecting him that day. This complaint centers on the conduct of the prison in repeatedly failing to allow him to effectively grieve that claim. In fact, he did exhaust his remedies because we find in the record the Carlos grievance, two grievances in January, all of which were not responded to. That means those are exhausted grievances. Those are the grievances in which Peter Lewis made explicit, I have received no response on my request to press charges. I have received no response on my request for a polygraph examination. It is those grievances which have been exhausted which allow the claim to go forward in court. And I would grant you, if the complaint he filed in federal court was simply, Lieutenants Shaw and Jones did not protect me and I was beaten and I would like money for the damages I suffered as a result of the beating, there would be an argument that he failed to exhaust if this court did not accept my argument that the 30-day window was told while the prison officials were mulling about with their various requests. But because this is a complaint about procedural problems, about a prison system trying to smother claims by repeatedly ignoring an inmate, that is a complaint for which grievances have been exhausted. I would reserve any balance of my time.
You've got about 1 minute. All right.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Counsel. My name is Brett Wagner. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the defendants in this case. Your Honors, Lewis's complaint was correctly dismissed for failure to exhaust his administrative remedies pursuant to the PLRA. Liberally construed, Lewis's complaint concerned two claims: the failure to protect slash deliberate indifference claim, also referred to as the staff conduct claim, and the conspiracy claim that the prison officials conspired to prevent him from bringing grievances.
If we agree with your position, won't we be reading the PLRA so narrowly as to permit IDOC to exploit the exhaustion requirement through sort of indefinite delay to the response to grievances?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that if there was a situation in which the department was not responding to grievances in a timely manner, there, you know, there are certainly remedies such as state court mandamus, things like that the prisoner can pursue. If there's a situation where the department is not responding to grievances and there are some sort of facts that can show that the department's not doing that for the purpose of preventing a resolution on those grievances, then the claim would probably, you know, be able to go on. But that's not the situation here. Here, Lewis filed the two October 1997 grievances. The staff conduct grievance was resolved. It was the grievance officer's report specifically says, this grievance is denied. You have 30 days from the day you receive this to appeal it to the director by way of the administrative review board. And Lewis did not do that. And that is one of the two claims she raises in his complaint. The other claim, the complaint, the conspiracy, was never grieved. He never initiated the grievance process. It was clearly not exhausted.
Well, where did the district court address the conspiracy claim or even determine whether or not Lewis had exhausted administrative remedies on the conspiracy claim?
Well, looking at the record, the notion that this complaint is about a conspiracy claim, let alone primarily about a conspiracy claim, is raised for the first time in the amicus brief. Primarily, before the district court, this was about the staff conduct deliberate indifference.
Primarily. What about the rest? What about secondarily? Thirdly?
Even if the district court did not specifically address the conspiracy claim, saying he didn't exhaust, he didn't exhaust. He did not file a grievance on the conspiracy claim. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was just going to say that, you know, the district court looked at the case and dismissed it with leave to reinstate, provided that Lewis come forth with something, you know, sufficiently compelling, you know, to say, well, exhaustion, you know, I did exhaust, or exhaustion wasn't required in this case for some reason. Lewis had the burden, but did not make that showing. And so the court, as it said in its April 4th minute order, indicated that, well, this case is dismissed. Lewis did not make the showing. Both of these claims, the staff conduct and the conspiracy claims, are subject to the PLRA's exhaustion requirement. The United States Supreme Court has recently...
How should we factor in Lewis's telling Warden Gramley that he wanted a polygraph and that he wanted to press criminal charges against Carlos?
Well, I believe... letter, he first told Gramley that in a letter, I believe, to which he didn't receive a response, and then he had actually a conversation with him, with the warden. Those events happened after the 30 days had run. Those shouldn't be factored in. The time had run. And sort of within that, you know...
It's sort of a catch-22, isn't it?
Well, I sort of want to make clear a point that, you know, Lewis wants... you know, to press charges against Carlos, right? So he's invoking some sort of prosecutorial discretion here. And he wants the polygraph test, and he wants the internal affairs report. He doesn't have a right to a polygraph test. He certainly could have appealed the staff conduct grievance and asked the administrative review board and the director in his, you know, grievance to, you know, appeal for a polygraphic exam. Nor does he have a right to the internal affairs report. This is a prison, you know, security document that, that the prison prepared. What Lewis has a right to is to have that, or a right under the grievance procedure. He has a right to have that looked at by the administrative review board and the director. It's not necessarily the case that he has a right to see it himself. He has a right for the sort of administrative appellate body to look at it and to consider the charges. So essentially what I'm saying at this point is that all these separate requests that he undertook, you know, he went down his own path after he received the grievance officer's report, you know, with all these claims for a polygraph exam and for the internal affairs report. He didn't need a response on any of those to pursue an appeal of the staff conduct grievance. That grievance specifically didn't – the grievance officer's report, approved by the chief administrative officer, specifically denied that grievance and said, you have 30 days. He could have then asked the director and the administrative review board to look at the internal affairs report and to consider his request for a polygraph if they thought it was necessary. All the things that happened after the time had run, again, can't form the basis of any sort of estoppel claim.
Do you want to say a word about the Fifth Circuit, or would you prefer not to?
The Fifth Circuit, in what context?
Wright versus Hollingsworth. That's the one circuit that's held that equitable estoppel can apply to the PLRA.
Well, basically, you know, and this court is held in Perez that the exhaustion requirement is not jurisdictional. And whether something is jurisdictional, that's essentially the traditional bar to the application of equitable estoppel. And this court's also held in Gibson that the sort of exhaustion requirement in the EEOC is subject to the equitable estoppel defense. I would argue, despite that, and despite the Fifth Circuit's holdings, that this court shouldn't undertake an equitable estoppel analysis, because that would involve some sort of trial, some sort of fact-finding at this initial stage, which is, you know, entirely contrary to the, you know, provisions of the PLRA. The PLRA was trying to, you know, accomplish a number of objectives here, including, you know, reducing the court burden brought by prisoner suits, and instead, you know, allowing the prison to resolve these things first.
Of course, non-jurisdictional prerequisites to suit in federal court are typically subject to equitable estoppel, are they not?
Correct. Correct. And I think I acknowledge that in my brief. So that's what, you know, primarily we argue that to the extent equitable estoppel can apply, the Gibson versus West standard of affirmative misconduct is required.
How much of what we're hearing today, an argument on behalf of the appellant, was presented to the district court?
Well,
do you know?
Not in the exact way. A lot of the appellant's facts, or the facts that are presented on behalf of the appellant, were submitted by Lewis in his submission in support of, you know, his position, why his complaint should not be dismissed for exhaustion of remedies. So sort of at that, they're not in the complaint, certainly. So they were presented in a way. I think they're newly characterized today,
but it's fair
sort
to
of
say
dramatically.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
It's fair to say they were presented, isn't it?
I think that is for the facts that the amicus draws on were certainly presented to do the district court, repackaged now, but presented to the district court.
As far as the argument?
The argument, I don't believe, certainly the estoppel argument wasn't raised, really. Again, this is difficult because we're dealing with, you know, a prisoner at the district court, so what he was trying to say doesn't necessarily come through in his pleadings. So I think that's sort of difficult to – I can't really say what he's trying to do at that court. If Your Honors have no further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
In response to Judge Kaney's question, I would say that the reason more argument on this wasn't presented in the district court, if you look in the short appendix, I've excerpted portions of the merit review hearing where when Peter Lewis went into why he didn't receive responses to various requests, the district court cut him off and moved to the role of upper-level administrators in his beating. And so it is the district court's responsibility that this was not further fleshed out. Aside, and in addition, until this court makes clear that equitable estoppel is available, it's hard to expect a prisoner to litigate it. I would also note that we do not believe that Mr. Lewis has some right or don't press the claim that he has a right to a polygraph or a right to an investigation report. We're saying he has a right to a yes or no answer. And if the answer is no, you have to say no. And if you're not going to say no and you're going to let it drag out, it's expected that the prisoner would wait for the yes or no before filing an appeal. Because as the Illinois regulations instruct a prisoner, if there is another way or if there's some way that your problem can be resolved at a lower level, you should try and pursue it. That's the logic of exhaustion of remedies generally, as well as the internal procedure of Illinois. In addition, I would simply note that the December 9th letters do show that these requests were made before the 30-day window, and for that reason, we ask that the district court be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will proceed to the next case, please.